It's a song that's kind of gained a lot of popularity throughout the United States, throughout the world. It's a song called Good, Good Father. And it's a song that we're looking at this evening as we continue on in this series called Songs for the Summer, as we look at some of the songs that that really have gripped us, that really have captured us, and to look at what's beneath it, and what's the word, what's the song saying, and what's the message in it. And you hear these two people going back and forth. One of them is Chris Tomlin, who had no part in writing the song, but he's interviewing one of the writers of the song, and he's talking about what went behind it. And I don't know if you caught it, he talked about one of the writers, the co-writers of the song, was somebody who grew up without a father. And he wrote this as a response to the need of having a heavenly father. And there's this interesting phrase that comes in the second verse of this song, and it says, "We've all been searching for answers that only you can provide." It's this plea, it's this statement, it's this proclamation about the reality of the power of God. I've been thinking about that this week. Thinking about it a lot since last Sunday morning as we woke up and we heard about another tragedy. But more tragic in the sheer volume of people who lost their lives, the sheer violence of it, the act behind it and the reasoning behind it. And it causes us, I think, to step back and to wonder, why does this continue to happen? How does this continue to happen? And what can we do to make it all stop? We're searching for answers that seem to be elusive, that we can't find. Remember, early on in my time here at Hope, I was asked to preside over a funeral for somebody who had lost their life, lost it tragically. And I remember I called my dad because I didn't know what to say. I mean, to be honest with you, it's not like we go to seminary and they tell us here's the best ways to deal with the most difficult tragedies. I had no clue. I was walking into a situation where I felt way outside of my ability. So I called my dad and I said, "Hey, here's the situation. And I'm going to need to say something about where is God in this and why did this happen?" And all of those things, similar questions that we ask when we think about Orlando. And my dad said, "Go to Deuteronomy 29:29. Deuteronomy 29:29 says, "There are the mysterious things, the hidden things of God." Sometimes we face situations that in our humanity, we don't have the ability to answer. Paul says it this way in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. He says, "This side of heaven, in our humanity, we look at things as if we're looking through a dimly lit mirror. We only see things with partial clarity." Deuteronomy 29:29 does go on, however, doesn't leave us empty with no answer. It says there are the mysterious, the hidden things of God that we just do not know. But then there are the things that we do know. And what we do know is the power of we come here today to acknowledge, to celebrate. What we do know is that we have a good, good Father. That's who He is. That there is nothing evil, there is nothing bad, there is nothing wrong, there is nothing that's not powerful about this God that we have. He's good. And who He is gives us identity, it gives us value, it gives us purpose, it gives us direction. It gives us the hope in the midst of despair. And I know that there are a lot of people that are here coming to worship that come. And Father's Day isn't something that you celebrate at all. I'd say Father's Day and Mother's Day for me is something that I hear more from people than any other days of the year. People will send emails, they'll give phone calls, they'll send me messages on Facebook, and they'll just say, "Please, please speak and be sensitive to those of us who don't rejoice on a day like Father's Day." Maybe Father's Day isn't what you have dreamed it would be because something in your relationship with your own father has been fractured. It's been lost. Your father wasn't somebody who was loving towards you. It was abusive mentally, emotionally, maybe physically. Or maybe you're a father and you've lost your relationship with one of your children. And this is just a reminder of what you've lost. Or maybe it's the fact that you've physically lost your father. Perry Ross, who's our director of worship here at Hope, he came into my dad's office. We were hanging out on Thursday. We were talking about what we were going to preach about. And what we do so many times when we get together is we laugh probably more than we should. We have so much fun together. It's not that it's always been easy, but we laugh a lot. And Perry walked into my dad's office and he said, "I just got to tell you guys how much I love seeing you work together." He said, "I also have to tell you that this is hard for me because I lost my father early." Perry lost his dad when his dad was in his early 50s. He said, "My dad never was able to see this side of me. And so I see it and I think it's amazing, but it also makes me lonesome for my father." But it's not that it's always been easy for us either. Don't let us fool you. I mean, we honestly, we have probably more stories than we would like to even admit of ways in which we could really throw each other under the bus.
Mm-hmm. More than that. Many of you have commented to me how blessed I must be to be able to do ministry right next door to Jeremy, our son, and it's amazing. It's not something that I ever thought would happen, but it has happened, and I'm very thankful to God every day. And it is my privilege to look at him and to see what he's doing, and I just have to admit, there are a lot of times I just look at him and say, "I don't think I could do that." And I say that with real admiration. But there have also been times in my life when I have looked at him and I have said, "I don't think I could do that," and it wasn't the greatest admiration. And I want to tell you about one of those times. We were in Fargo at Hope Lutheran, and we were going to start a second campus, a satellite, and the only church I knew that had one at that time was North Heights in the Twin Cities, Maury Vogdas, pastor. I knew him a little bit because I had met at meetings with him, but there was still a distance about us, and so I gave him a call and made a date to go down and take that 230-mile trip to the Twin Cities, and I was going to visit him, and it so worked out that our daughter was going to go to college, her freshman year. And she was going to go to college down near the cities, and so I could take her down there and drop her off. Benita, wife, could not go because she was a teacher. It was that time of the year, teacher's prep. She wasn't allowed to have that time off. And so it ended up that in the car that day going down there was Jeremy, who then was going to be a ninth grader, and Kirsten, who was going to be a freshman in college. And so I was all excited about this. I had 100 questions to ask Maury, and I had so much that I was going to do. And of course, then we got there, and I wanted them to see this new church that had been built, and I was all excited about it. And we got there, and of course, I wanted our children to make a good impression on Maury. And so we got there and introduced, and he took us around the church, and I noticed that Jeremy wasn't acting all that impressed. There was a certain distance about him. And so anyway, then came this decision or this invitation that kind of sealed the disaster, I think. And that is that Maury invited not only me into his office, but also Jeremy and Kirsten, our daughter. And so I remember going into the office, and the first thing I noticed was how relatively small it was. And I suppose the reason was this was a second site, and so it was just a working office for Maury. But Maury's desk in that small office was diagonal across the corner and facing kind of out towards the door. The door was near a corner. And as Maury looked over his desk, there were two simple chairs. And then on the other side, there was this huge overstuffed recliner. Just huge. Just took up, monopolized the room. So the minute we entered that door, Jeremy saw exactly the chair he was going to sit in and made a beeline for that big overstuffed chair, plopped himself down, made himself comfortable, and Kirsten and I took the two simple chairs, and the conversation began back and forth, until I heard this noise, this loud noise from my left. I looked over, and there's Jeremy with his hand on the lever, and he's cranking that thing, and all of a sudden, the chair just sprawls out, so that now when I'm looking at Maury, I'm looking over his sneakers. And he settles in, and he's oblivious, and I'm thinking, I don't think I could do that. Well, anyway, it goes from bad to worse, because about 10 minutes later, we hear this deep breathing. And I turn over, and there is Jeremy, sound asleep. Anyway, when we got out to the car, I really think we laughed. Because what can you do at a time like that? And besides, we knew we had just experienced something together that we were never going to forget. So it hasn't always been a proud moment to be with the chair, but most of the time.
But there was also a time when we were at our lake cabin. I mean, if you get to tell one, I get to tell one. And I was about a fifth grader, and as a fifth grader, my sister was 4 years older than me, my brother was 7 years older than me, so I didn't have anybody to play with. And my parents had a problem because I was so young, they didn't want me around as much anymore. I mean, I was kind of the cast-off kid. I say that jokingly. They actually didn't treat me like that. But it felt like it sometimes. So they go, just busy yourself. Well, we had a six-horse fishing boat, three benches in it, the motor on the back, and it was wonderful. It was beautiful. And my parents let me ride it whenever I wanted to. But there's only one reason, only one rule that they gave me. The only time I could drive that boat was if they were on the dock watching. They never said anything about a life jacket, and I always thought to myself, well, that's interesting. Do you just want to watch me go down? I don't know. And so I'm going out, and I would do figure eight so I could go over all the waves. My mom and dad are on the dock. They're having their coffee. And all of a sudden, in the middle of that ride that evening, as it's getting to be the most beautiful time of the day, all of a sudden, without warning, the motor falls off the back of the boat. And I'm a fifth grader kid. I'm like 9 years old. And the only thing I can do in that moment, I don't know how I held on to the motor, but I held on to the motor. And the motor, that thing is heavy. It's an old Evinrude motor. It starts dragging me down, so I kick my foot up. So I have the motor dragging me down, my foot kicked under the bench in front of me, and I'm like a tension rod caught between two things that are going the opposite direction. And I start screaming. Yelling at the top of my, screaming, help me, help, help. And then I hear the voice of my father, who I expect is going to give this immediate response of something that's going to deliver me from this literal hell that I found myself in. And I hear this voice of my dad that says, whatever you do, don't drop the motor. And I've been talking to people about that ever since. Because I thought to myself, I expected a lot more from you than that. Because in that moment, and they came and they got me, and everything was fine. But I needed my father. And I think when we take stock of the life that we all live, we need to know that there's somebody that's there that gives us safety and security. And that's what we celebrate in the bigger day, today at Father's Day. Because from an earthly perspective, no matter how great our dads are, they're still human. And we need something more. And what we see when we look at the Gospels, when we look at the Bibles, we see this picture of Jesus. And Jesus in a relationship with his God that redefines what a father truly looks like and redefines the way in which we look at God.
It's absolutely astonishing when you take a look at the evolving concept of God among the Jewish people from the beginning. And what is so outstanding about it is that it is totally different than anything else in the other religions that surrounded them. It is totally, absolutely unique. And through the centuries, God revealed himself. And the Jewish people discovered this. And one of the things during the course of the time was the idea that God was Father. However, God was Father in those verses more like potter and clay, God the Creator. Although there is in the 103rd Psalm a reference to God as Father and in a very caring fashion. And also, I think it's in Psalm 69 that talks about God being the father of the fatherless. But the whole concept of God as Father remains pretty well on the periphery until Jesus. And when Jesus came, he made it the main thing. 150 times in the Gospels, we hear God referred to as Father. There's wonderful stories that we read about the fatherhood, the caring of God. And this was totally unique to them. The image of God as Father, a good Father, has so many things that we could talk about, but I want to talk about just one. And that was that time when Jesus was in the boat with the disciples and they were crossing the Lake of Galilee. And that was a lake that was notorious for storms that could come up, and wind that could blow, and they leave in the evening and they're going to travel across at night. And the picture is Jesus asleep on a cushion in the front of that frail fishing boat. And then a storm came up. And the disciples were sure that they were going to die. And they cry out to Jesus, "Jesus, don't you care?" And when Jesus awoke, he calmed the storm. And then he questioned their faith in God. What we see in Jesus in the boat, before sleeping, we see a state of blessedness. For Jesus, the world was a safe place, as ultimately it is for us. And so Jesus is resting, believing and knowing that the wind, the sea, the dark, under it all are the everlasting arms of God. And you and I have been in the middle of storms ourselves. And we've come to a place where we've called out to God. And we've asked for God. And then there came that time of surrender when somehow God enabled us to just surrender it to him as our Father. Didn't necessarily mean that it turned out the way that we wanted, but we were able to lean back into those arms and find a rest and a blessedness that we didn't know would be there.
It's in the book of Romans. It's in Romans chapter 8. There's It's an incredible chapter of Paul's letter to the Romans. Paul writes to a group of people, and he's writing about the truth and the reality of God, and he's writing it in a way of great certainty. And Paul is an absolute genius. Paul's writings, his letters, his words of encouragement, his instructions to that early church are things that we still look at today, and we look at and we follow, and we gain insight and revelation from Paul's words. And Paul uses his words and chooses his words very carefully. In Romans chapter 8, Paul starts to talk about this life and the outpouring of God's love through his Spirit that joins to us, that gives and creates in us an entirely new life. And Paul talks about what this new life is, and he says in Romans chapter 8, he says, it's because of God's Spirit that's poured out to us, that through that we have a connection with God, we have an intimacy with God that nothing else can compare to. And he says, because of that, all of us, not just a chosen few, not just those who get it right, not just those who were born to a certain family in a certain region, but all people, regardless of where they've come from, regardless of what they've done, that we all can cry out, Abba, Father. Referencing back to this intimate relationship that Jesus had with his Father. And Paul's saying that that's the same for us. Paul chooses those words so carefully. He uses the word Abba, which is an Aramaic word. The New Testament is written in the language of Greek. It's written in Greek. But Paul, for some reason, in this passage, Paul chooses to keep the Aramaic word Abba in there. It's Abba, the Aramaic, followed by the Greek word pater, which means father. And so often when we see this word Abba, we think about it and we translate it as daddy, which I think is a fair translation, but I don't think it does it justice. I think about when Jesus is praying to his Father in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus is just moments from a time in which his life is going to be taken from him. And Jesus falls to his knees and he calls out to his Father, and I believe he wants something more. Oh yes, Abba is most definitely a term of endearment, but it's a term, it's from the Hebrew word av, which means my father or our father. It's a statement of who this person is. And Paul says, because of the outpouring of God's love and his Spirit to us through Jesus Christ, that we all can have that relationship that Jesus had with his Father, so that we all can cry out and have this connection that assures us that we'll be heirs everything that is his. There's nothing that can separate us from that. And as his heirs, we are promised everything. And we're given safety and security in the knowledge that we have a space and a place with him. Jesus talks about this. Luke chapter 15, it's a story that many of us know quite well. I would say of all of the parables that Jesus told, this one probably stands out for most people. It's the story of the prodigal son. It's a story of a father who has two children, and these two children are going about their business, tending to the land that is their father's, tending the land that will someday be theirs. We don't know the reason, and we don't know all of the things that were going on at the time, but for whatever reason, one of the sons turns to his father one day and says, "You know what, Dad? I'm tired of living in your house. I don't want any part of it any longer. In fact, I would rather that you would just give me my share of the inheritance now." Basically, he's telling his dad, "Dad, you're as good as dead to me. I have no use for you any longer." And not out of apathy, and not out of a posture of saying, "Well, you'll get what you deserve." Father gives him what he asks for. And the son leaves the only place he's ever known. in pursuit of what he feels will be a better life. And he goes out, and the Bible tells us that he goes out and he spends all of his money lavishly. We could say foolishly. Before too long, the money runs dry. He has nothing left. He has no place to go. As soon as the money goes, so does the party that surrounds him, and he's left all alone, away from home. It's famine that comes through the land, and so food is hard to come by, and the only possibility that this son has to survive is to become a servant. And he has the lowest of jobs in the house of the master he serves. And he starts to ask himself, why did I ever leave? Could I ever go back? Because even the servants in my father's home live better than I'm living right now. The trouble is that he'd made his decision. He'd left. He'd burned that bridge on the way out. Do you ever feel that way? In life? You look at what it used to be and how it used to be, and so oh, how you'd love to be able to go back to it. That somehow you pursued something and you thought it was going to turn out so great, and somehow when you got to the end of that road, it just didn't give you what you thought it would give you. I mean, I think that's so natural to the human experience. We start to think to ourselves, I could never go back to the way it was. I could never go back to that place where I knew that I was loved and I was provided for. And I had a place. It's a story that's not unique to the prodigal son at all, is it?
I came to a point where I got involved in a D-Men program while I was serving the parish, which meant that I had to spend a month at the beginning of it out at the seminary. And while I was there, just about ready to return, I got a phone call from Benita, and she told me that that day she'd discovered and been to the doctor with Jeremy and found out that he had diabetes. And I got on the plane and came home. And when I got home, Benita and I spent a lot of time discussing, researching, talking, comforting each other. And through it all, we made a really bad mistake. And that is that the two other children were kind of left out of it all. And we didn't pay attention and care for them and include them in the way we should have. And about a month and a half later, our daughter, who was in a ninth grade at that time, it began to really change. Her whole attitude changed, her friends changed, her grades changed. We even went to the principal, she was in ninth grade, and talked to them, and yes, they'd all noticed that. And we just found ourselves beyond our map. We didn't know what to do. Anything that we were doing didn't seem to work. And I just remember pleading with her, don't do this. Don't do this. You've got such a wonderful life ahead of you. Don't throw it away now. And I remember her bursting into tears saying, that only makes me feel worse. And so we were really directed to the right person. We went to a family therapist. I don't know if he was a Christian or not. But we sat down with him and we poured out what was happening, and he listened and we talked and discussed things back and forth. And then we were just about to leave the first session we had with him. And then in my anxiety, I said, do you think we can ever get her back? And he said, you will, if you can convince her that you love her unconditionally. That has given me a different insight into the father of the prodigal son. Because not only when his son left did he miss his presence, but all the expectations he had for his son died. The death of your expectations. Because there comes a point when our children can say to us that they don't want to be there any longer, that they don't want to live in the house any longer, and they can leave because power isn't going to do it anymore. Authority isn't going to do it anymore. And so I had to deal with my expectations. Not only my expectations for her, but my expectations of what she could have for herself. The life that she, I believe, deserved. I think her mother did that better than I did, but I really worked at it. And I looked at all those other kids that she used to be friends of, and I just mourned. And then, slowly, after about 3-4 months, we began to see a change. About that time, a group of our kids, kind of like we saw here, went to San Antonio for a youth convention. And Kirsten was one of those. I don't know what happened one night there, but our older son was there as well, and I know something very special happened within that group, between those kids. And Kirsten came back very different. The death of expectations. It's called unconditional love. And another name we give for it is grace. The grace of God.
It's what the prodigal son experiences. I mean, he comes home. I don't know how hard that was for him to make his way home, but I believe that there was something in the back of his mind. Even though he wouldn't entertain the thought that somehow it could be true, somehow he decided that he would go home, and oh, what a glorious day it was when that father who desperately loved his son, who ached every day that he was gone, saw his son eclipsing the horizon, making his way home, coming into his father's home, trying to give all of the reasons on why he had screwed up, and the dad just said, "You're home. You're home." It's what God does for all of us. That's the grace that Paul is writing about that gives us the ability to cry out, "Abba, Father," that the God who created the heavens and the earth and everything in between, that God who is infinite becomes finite so that we can be in a relationship with him and have the security and the assurance that nothing in all of creation, Paul will go on in Romans chapter 8. Paul says, what do we say about such wonderful things as these? If God is for us, who could ever be against us? Does it mean he no longer loves us if we face danger or calamity or we're destitute? No. Overwhelming victory is ours through Christ who loved us. Because neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor demons, nor things above or things below, not even the powers of hell, Paul says, could ever separate you from the love of God that comes through Christ Jesus our Lord. We're all searching for answers that only He can provide. He's a good, good Father. And you're loved by Him unconditionally. It's no merit. He gives it to you freely to give you a place, to welcome you home. Let that be our prayer this evening as we sing this song. Let it be our prayer for those who are suffering in Orlando. Let it be for those who are mourning the own realities that may exist in our life, but also be our prayer in the midst of our rejoicing. That we have a God who gets to define who we are and what's possible for us. So would you please stand and sing and worship with us this evening? Amen.
Still as you call me, deeper. It's who I am.